I'm Sam Roggeveen, Senior Fellow at the Lowy Institute, and welcome to Camera Conversations, the first in a new occasional podcast series on The Interpreter, where I talk with some of the big names in the foreign policy and national security worlds here in Canberra. The aim is to talk to these important personalities about their lives, their influences, and how they do their jobs. In a coming episode of Canberra Conversations, I talk to the Secretary of the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, Francis Adamson. But in this episode, I'm with Mike Pezzullo, Secretary of the Department of Immigration and Border Protection. Prior to this appointment, Mike Pezzullo was Chief Executive Officer of the Australian Customs and Border Protection Service and Deputy Secretary Strategy in the Department of Defence, where in 2009 he played a major role in the drafting of the Defence White Paper. Mike Pezzullo joined the Defence Department as a graduate in 1987. He also worked in the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet, in the Office of Foreign Minister Gareth Evans, and he was Deputy Chief of Staff to Kim Beazley when he was opposition leader. I spoke to Mike Pezzullo in his office in Canberra. Another departmental officer was also present, and you'll hear Pezzullo refer to him briefly at one point in the recording. Well, Mike Pezzullo, thanks for taking the time.
Pleasure. Hi, Sam.
I appreciate you doing this today, and I want to start by going back to your early life, actually, and your family background. Were there family or other early life influences that led to your interest in public policy?
Not directly so, other than as is, I think, often the case with a lot of public servants, especially in that period. I joined the public service in the 80s. Many of us came from what you would still describe as working class backgrounds. I came up through the Catholic parish system. One was always very attuned to the fact that the state's got an important role to play in either making your life a bit easier, giving you opportunities, providing educational opportunities and the like. But in terms of my immediate family, both mum and dad came to Australia in the early 60s in what I suppose you would generously describe as unskilled and semi-skilled roles. They were part of that great post-war migration boom where the country was really after that kind of labour. And secondly, they were after the building of population through the creation of new families. So they tended to target the programs run by the department that I ironically head now, targeted semi-skilled and unskilled younger heterosexual couples to essentially have children. And I'm one of those children.
So politics wasn't discussed around the dinner table?
Very rarely. I do recall as I was in my in the 70s, so I was in 8, 9, 10, the dismissal of the Whitlam government, for instance, was discussed. I won't breach my late father's privacy as to indicate whether he was angered by that or joyous, but it was one of those two reactions. But it was only dealt with in the most superficial of terms. It wasn't a particularly political family. And a lot of migrants who'd come in that period frankly felt that politics was something they'd left behind in Europe. Australia presented an opportunity where the state, by and large, left you alone, but it gave you opportunities if you worked hard, particularly if you then invested in property. You built your wealth. You had 2, 3, and sometimes 4 jobs, depending on the circumstances of the time, with the women tending to be the ones who stayed at home as the homemakers, but even they would engage in a lot of part-time work to supplement the income. And politics was in a way that might be odd to your listeners today, was considered as something, certainly in my family and extended family, something that was part of their past back in Europe, and in a sense they'd left it behind.
So university then, were you politicised at university, if that's the phrase?
Not directly, in the sense that I didn't join any of the clubs, and I tended to be very academically engaged in issues, that arose in my history lectures, political science, government and public administration, as the course was called in Sydney Uni. And I knew that the politically active students were around me and they were kind of interesting to talk to. But I had an instinctive view, and I hope that people who are now my peers looking back 30 years don't take this in a dismissive way, but I just didn't see how you had the life experience at that age to really have much to add in terms of any great wisdom. So I had plenty of friends in all the different political clubs, but I didn't join and I didn't partake.
So your interests, I think, at university or even before were in military history and military strategy, and then perhaps at university broadened into politics. Is that fair to say?
Yes.
So were there particular figures at Sydney University who influenced you, or was it more your worldview was formed by what you read?
A combination. I studied under professors that I have still got the highest regard for: Richard Bosworth in the history faculty, Patricia Springborg and Michael Jackson in the government faculty. They taught me a lot, both in terms of the content of their courses, but also how they went about their teaching. Michael and Patricia, particularly political philosophy, political theory, going right back to Plato, Aristotle, and coming through to the great modern thinkers, and Richard Bosworth, who's now at Oxford, still writing, so he's, you'd say, semi-retired, late modern European history. And my period of fascination was the 19th century and leading up into the 20th century, the outbreak of the First World War, the interwar years, the rise of fascism, the conflict with communism, the outbreak of the Second World War, and then I stopped at about the start of the Cold War in the 40s and 50s. Anything after that, at least when I was at uni, was a bit modern.
Mm. So in that sort of classic spectrum of political philosophy, with communism on the left, fascism on the right, conservatism, liberalism, socialism, and so on in between, where do you put yourself?
I saw myself then and now as a parliamentary Democrat, as someone who I looked at those philosophies very, very closely, and it struck me that the benefit we have in a democracy is that if you put in place the right institutions with ways in which issues can be surfaced, votes can be taken, legislation can be passed, people are wise enough to pursue their own course. So which is handy, given that I'm a federal public servant and a Commonwealth secretary, it's handy not to have a kind of political leaning in that sense, but to actually understand that the institutions themselves are the most important thing.
And I think at one time you contemplated the idea of, with your love of history, of becoming a professor of history, of becoming an academic. So were there particular historical figures that were influential for you, that shaped you?
Yes, if you could get tenure, by the mid-80s, a lot of the tenured positions had already been taken up because of the expansion of the university sector in the 70s, and those professors weren't going anywhere anytime soon. But no, had I been able to pursue chosen to pursue an academic career, I would have very much focused on the lead up to the Second World War and particularly the grand strategy of the Allies. So I was always devoured anything on Churchill, Roosevelt, how they came to decisions, how they made choices about defeating Germany first, for instance, before swinging their attention to Japan. That's from that sort of broader sweep I described before. That's the period that I really started to focus in on and had my deepest interest in.
This is a bit of an aside because I want to just move back to your personal circumstances, but that answer prompts me to ask you something about the way we look at Asia today. I've had similar interests to yours in the past, studying largely European history, and I've often felt when I study contemporary Asian strategic issues that holds me back a little bit, that strong influence of Eurocentric thinking holds me back a little from understanding Asia fully. Do you agree?
Yes, I do. And I think and that certainly characterised the historiography of the period that I just described. As I've thought about these issues in the spare time that one gets over the course of 30 years of keeping my hand in just as an amateur, looking at Eurasia as an integrated system helps to defeat that Eurocentrism. So even through the 19th and 20th centuries, the critical importance of China, of Japan, indeed Japan's rise as part of that period that I described earlier, wasn't just a sideshow. It was actually part of an evolving global geostrategic system. And in recent years, I've actually become interested and I've gone back to some of the classic geostrategists, Mackinder and Mahan and Spikeman and people like that, who treated geostrategy not as a Eurocentric concept, but actually as a Eurasian construct. Now, that it's got its own limitations because it tends to marginalise other areas of the world like Latin America and Africa, but at least it gives you a more cohesive and comprehensive view of both Europe and Asia. And I think you're right, Sam. I think that for those of us who came up the classical historical tradition, you've really got to, in a sense, overcorrect through international relations and strategic studies to really focus on Asia. And then I think there's still a trap, though, in becoming then an Asia specialist who ignores the other side of that Eurasian system. I think the better way to think about it, and I think diplomacy's caught up with this. We think of the Indo-Pacific, for instance, but in, as an aside, coming into the contemporary period, you see Chinese strategy built on a Eurasian context or Eurasian construct with One Belt, One Road. You see the Russians treating Eurasia as an integrated system. The Americans increasingly thinking about Eurasia as an integrated system. You know, whether they're thinking about their strategic obligations and commitments to, in Eastern Europe, the Persian Gulf or the Middle East, the Indo-Pacific, and developments in the Western Pacific. I think we're going back to what was actually a classical 19th century idea of Eurasia. And I think that's a very fine thing because I think just correcting back to Asia and ignoring Europe is itself as deficient as the other tendency.
Okay, as I said, that's an aside. I want to get back and talk a little bit more about you and ask about your earlier life. You said in a recent interview that when you were a schoolboy, you suffered a little bit from what we might call casual racism.
Yep.
Schoolmates called you a wog, a dago, or whatever.
Yep.
I think
Australia, we all got that. I got
clogwog.
Right.
At
okay.
school. Yeah.
Okay.
I think by any measure, Australia is an incredibly tolerant country. I'm sure you'd agree. I once heard Waleed Ali say that Australia has high levels of low-level racism, which struck me as a neat formulation. Do you agree? But and more importantly, if you agree, how much does it matter?
Well, look, in terms of when I was young, and because the reference you made related to my school days, it was water off a duck's back. It didn't particularly trouble me at all. It was as much said in light-hearted jest as anything else. It's you can almost put it down to kids being kids. And I think, frankly, it doesn't matter unless it's the start of a process whereby that, and it's not to condone it, but that sort of casual racism of the schoolyard, if it becomes something else where you objectify those groups into something to be ultimately hated and indeed ultimately dealt with through violent extremism, then it's absolutely a problem. But the casual, and I think that's a good description of it, the casual racism that I encountered in my school days in the 70s, I don't look back on it with any kind of sense of deep concern. It's nothing that that has ever affected me in terms of how I've lived my life. And it's a reminder, in fact, that whether it's race or whether it's other forms of describing people's identity, you do need to be very careful because I was quite resilient. I didn't really care about it, but other people take it to heart. Mm-hmm. It can create psychological and other stresses in terms of someone's self-belief, self-awareness, self-identity. And especially now with the advent of the internet age and social media, I think the rules have changed. I think we should be very, very careful, and we should be very careful in terms of how we set examples to our children and how we educate them about, particularly about social media. What in the 70s might have been just dismissed water off a duck's back, these days echoes through social media, it echoes through the internet. That stuff's never erased, and it can affect different people in different kinds of ways. Ironically, our kids probably today need to be even more resilient as communication has proliferated and the ability of basically anyone on one part of the globe to comment on or to objectify or to insult someone else on any other part of the globe. I think, ironically, the best antidote to all of that is actually old-fashioned manners and civility and mutual respect. Yes. And so it's not about learning anything new. To some extent, it's about going back to older ideas of civility and politeness.
Do you feel like it ever affected your career? Did it matter that? Do you ever feel like it mattered that your name's Pizzullo and not Smith?
No, I've never felt that was an issue at all.
So where do you stand on this idea? I know it's been tried around the public service in various parts of blind recruitment, the idea that you, when you're recruiting someone, you remove their names, their age, their gender, and so on, so that you get what's, I think, designed at least to be a purer recruitment process rather than influenced subjectively by gender, race, other issues.
I've not really immersed myself in the literature. I know as secretaries we've had some presentations and I know some interesting trials have been run intuitively, and I'm not speaking to the science of it, I just haven't done a lot of research in the area. It slightly troubles me if, because whatever you decide as being the key metric that is going to be the determinant of whether someone gets a job or not, it's always going to be a subset of who that person is. And I'm actually interested in someone's CV, their career, who they are, how they think. And I'm just not sure, I'm happy to be convinced otherwise in terms of the research, I'm just not sure that stripping away layers of identity is really the answer. I think instinctively the better approach is to be ruthless with your selection and recruitment processes to actively ensure that discrimination biases are out of the system. Now, masking or going blind with blind recruitment, I think was the term that was used in your question, might be an answer. I just am intuitively sceptical about any system that, if you like, deconstructs someone's identity to what the algorithm or the model says constitutes the person. I'm just wary of that, but I'm willing to look at the science in more detail.
So let me ask you some further questions about the public service. Dennis Richardson recently, in his farewell speech at the press club, he was asked in the Q&A period about, I think, a change of culture in the public service, where public servants felt more constrained in the advice they gave to politicians.
Yep.
And he gave this blunt answer, as you would expect from Dennis Richardson, that he said that bureaucrats who complain about being restricted by their political masters are just cowards.
I agree with Dennis, and I both watched his speech and listened to the Q&A very carefully. I agree with Dennis 1,000%. That I've never and both he and I have worked in some very contentious areas, edgy areas in terms of strategic risk and high profile and indeed controversial issues. I've never seen a minister behave in the way that the stereotypical, the trope of the minister doesn't want to hear bad news. They want to hear both what is the problem or the threat. What's your solution? And if I decide to go with one of the options that you're presenting to me, can you commit to action and can you deliver? And the public servants who say those things, perhaps cowardice might be a strong term, although I have seen instances of professional cowardice like that. Mm. It's more an aversion to, not so much even risk, but it's an aversion to accountability. Because ministers, and I say this about both sides of the aisle, ministers are not there to observe a problem. They need to know what the problem is. They need to know what are the drivers that have got us to that position that's created the problem, or what's the underlying trend, or what's the threat. They want, obviously, consistent with their values, their ideology, their party platform. Those things are their framing concepts, and you've got to respect that because we work for the party that's in government of the day, and they want to know options that are consistent with their priorities, their strategy, their value system and their ideology, and then they want to know that you can deliver. Having worked closely with both sides of politics, in agreeing with Dennis, would go even further to say ministers get quite frustrated at the timidity and the risk aversion that occasionally they might be confronted with.
That's a good point to end that answer, yeah, because it leads me directly to my next question. What do you think about the idea that the public service is becoming too safe in its culture? It hires really bright people, but they're mostly introverts who prefer not to stick their necks out. And anecdotally, at least, from the outside, there seems to be less room for eccentricity in the public service today, in the public service culture. Do you agree?
Well, I'll give you an answer based on my own experience. I've found that if you give people space, if you give them a sense of empowerment, that they can generate ideas, they're not going to have those ideas just marched out the door in the first sentence. That you say particularly to our young bright public servants, often just recently out of graduate programs or at a relatively early point in their career, some of the most brilliant thinking I've seen has come from those levels. And both the art and the science of leadership in the public service is to then leaven that with the experience and the wisdom, not the inertia and not the blocking tendencies that sometimes you can see in the public service, but to leaven that with what used to be called perhaps not entirely an absent phrase these days, but the wisdom of the greybeards who have seen lots of things, who know how to get things done, and the art and the science of modern public administration leadership is to bring together the insight, the brilliance, the fact that our younger recruits, our graduates, people in the early part of their career now are so tech savvy. They are digital natives. The insight that they bring, their ability to work through solutions using new technology and all the rest of it, and combining that with the insight, wisdom of those who have been around a while, who know how to get things done, that's the real art and science. If you overcorrect to the brilliance of youth, sometimes things that are a bit infeasible or unpractical can get too far up the system. But if you overly privilege caution, safety, everything has to be checked to, within an inch of its life, you potentially create inertia and paralysis in the system. And it's getting that balance right. And that's how you develop good policy. It's a combination of insight and wisdom and brilliance on occasions with achievability. What can be done, based on experience, based on a sensible approach to program or service delivery, and it's combining those two things that is, as I say, the sweet spot. In my experience, if you get those things right, the public service is as dynamic as any other part of our society, including the private sector. If you get that wrong, which I think is implied in at least characterisation in your question, yes, you can have a risk-averse, paralysed, timid public service, and that generates the frustration at the ministerial level that I described earlier and that I think Dennis is also speaking of.
So this brings me to the other subject I wanted to cover about how you work on a day-to-day basis. Mm. Contestability is always a big issue in the public service. Yep. Do you deliberately arrange your affairs, how you, the information that comes to you each day so that you are presented with ideas that you know are going to be challenging or difficult for you to...
Yes, and in fact, worse than that, from the point of view of those who might be risk-averse or timid, I arrange it so that I reach many levels down and often will... and this is you asked about great figures before that might have been inspirational. One leadership trick I certainly learned from Churchill, just reading about how he operated, is on occasions you need to not overdo it because otherwise your day just becomes full of reading raw intelligence, for instance, but making sure that you're, for instance, reading some of the constituent intelligence reports and not just relying on the summaries and diving into that and saying, hang on, how do we know that? Tell me more about this. And that sends signals through the whole system that your leader is alert, they're onto poignant and significant pieces of detail. And what that sends to the other layers of leadership is that they have to be similarly curious, alert, and willing to dive all through the system. Now, you don't want to overdo that so that everyone's just simply in this carnival of just constant dialogue and discussion, because you've then got to also land your options. You've got to secure ministerial authority and a political mandate for the strategy that emerges from those options, and then you've got to execute. And so you need a combination both of curiosity, contestability and discussion, but then you, in relation to a particular issue, be it a threat, a risk, a priority that has to be delivered against, you've then got to land a plan and execute to that plan.
What's your daily media diet? And are there particular writers, commentators that you go out of your way to make sure you catch as whenever possible?
Well, I'm always an avid reader of Lowy's Interpreter, as well as the obvious other great think tanks of the world, some of which you partner with and some with which might well be your competitors, so you can fill in the blanks as you wish. Look, I read, obviously, the key national press. We do have media summary services. I tend not to just rely on those. I like to go to the actual, although increasingly these days you do it online. But
do you use social media?
Not overly. I don't have a social media presence in terms of either Facebook or Twitter. Ben, I'm not sure if things are done in my name out there in social media. I tend not to, and I tend to believe it, certainly at my level, and I'm not a politician, and I don't need to, if you like, use the full range of tools that a politician necessarily needs to use. I believe that a senior official should use more classical forms. Now, that's not to say if we put out a press statement or an all-staff message, then it's not to say that our media people can't leverage off that and create tweets or links or whatever, and so I rely on our excellent staff to do that. But the morning routine is, I get up fairly early, so normally I'm digesting through the online feed that one gets by about 4:35 a.m. in the morning, and then and starting from there, I tend to hold back on the first tasking texts till about 6 a.m. so just to give the system a little bit of
I'm sure your staff are pleased.
They're geared for it though. Yeah.
Having worked in a number of tough portfolios that get a lot of public attention.
Yep.
What are your observations about the way media works in this country and how it interacts with the policy process? Is the media serving Australia well?
I'll leave the latter part of the question, even though there's part of me that is dying to answer it. I'll leave that part of the question to the side, and perhaps people will be able to infer an answer to that. In terms of, I've seen the cycle over now a quarter of a century. It is very different. The depth has gone, partly because the nature of the media model has essentially been confronted by the internet age. And so revenue models have changed. The ability of the great former mastheads or the great current mastheads to invest deeply in specialised journalism has completely been undermined. And you're competing with a broader milieu, because and there's all sorts of folks out there who blog and who commentate and who do online things, some of whom are very, very good and some of whom are charlatans. And so what tends to happen is that you've got a very fragmented media space that isn't just, if you like, channeled through four or five major newspapers or flagship TV or radio programs, which was the case in the late 80s, early 90s when I first came into public service. And so now you've got a broader and in a sense richer and more diverse milieu, but because of the cacophony effect, it's also more fragmented. And the thing that we have to really resist is just going to that media or part of the social media milieu that we're already predisposed to agree with, because otherwise you get this sort of echo chambering effect of people just reading particular blogs or reading particular commentators that in a sense are already going to reinforce the worldview that we already have. The media model in that sense is becoming more like what it used to be in the 19th century, where there were very fragmented newsletters or salons who would have a particular editorial or ideological view about facts, and people who are interested in that view would subscribe to those journals or would go to the salon to listen to the writers. And in a funny kind of way, we're going back to that more fragmented 19th century media model, but just obviously on a scale that's, you know, would have been incomprehensible to the folks who lived at that time. That's got some upside because you get a different range of voices, more diversity, you know, through the internet and Wikipedia and all the rest of it. You can sort of quickly research all sorts of things. I don't know that it generates more wisdom, though. It's made us perhaps cleverer and more knowledgeable, but I'm not sure it's made us wiser.
Final question.
Yeah.
Slightly unfair, perhaps, on no notice, but I think you're up to it. What's the biggest challenge this country faces in the next 10 years that no one's talking about?
It's difficult to answer in the sense that I think elements of the big challenges, including the greatest challenges, are all being talked about, but they're not necessarily being talked about in a coherent way simply because of that splintered and fragmented media effect that I just spoke about. So from my point of view, in the next 10 years, it is the geostrategic environment in which we live. Massive power shifts that are seeing 500 years of history. In shorthand, you might want to describe it as the Western era or the Western dominant era is being overturned and upended, and that's been discussed. But it's not as though you can't find a discussion of the mosaic of that issue. Issues around China's rise. Will China's rise be a peaceful one or potentially one that leads to other sorts of outcomes? America's role, and that's not just in relation to who happens to be in the White House at any one particular time, but what are the underlying tendencies in terms of America's role? The role of other regions, other rising players such as India. So in the next 10 to 15 years, and I'd put it out that far, Australia's place in the world and our geostrategic environment is the most profound question, simply because the consequences of catastrophic failure in that regard, which ultimately can include anything up to major power war. So when I came to Canberra in 1987, we were living then at the very tail end of the Cold War, under the threat, the very clear binary threat, Soviet Union and the US, of major power conflict, which could escalate at any given moment to a nuclear war. And of course, in 1983, we'd had the nuclear scare where the Soviets had thought through NATO exercise Able Archer, that the Americans were going to launch a strike. That was 4 years before I came to Canberra. And so that was very much with me. Then the Berlin Wall comes down, the Soviet Union's dissolved, the end of the Cold War, and we had that period. Fukuyama talked about the end of history. There was an ideological consensus around both liberal democracy, capitalist mode of production, an adherence to human rights. And for a period of time, at least in the 90s, that thesis appeared to be holding. That's changed again. And now some people would argue that was just a mirage in any event, and the historians will be examining that for centuries, I suspect, because of sort of masking other tendencies that geostrategically and geoeconomically have come to light in the time since. So whilst there are many, many challenges that confront us, the thing that I believe, and I suppose I would say this because I've spent most of my career in the national security community, that we really, really need to be focused on is Australia's geostrategic environment. Now, it's not fair to say that no one's talking about it, because we are. My question is, given the different voices you have out there, the fragmented nature of public discourse, are we talking about it in a coherent way, or are we talking about it through a mosaic? And I guess the point I'd make, and obviously governments have got a role to lead, so the government's at the moment putting the finishing touches on a foreign policy white paper, that will be a great opportunity to, again, bring coherence to these discussions. You have defence white papers, and I was very honoured to be associated with one a number of years ago. So governments have got a clear role in bringing these discussions together. But then, of course, what happens with the interests that people have, the fragmented nature of public discourse, you can bring it together for a period of time in a coherent way through a strategic statement, and you can pursue a coherent strategic policy, which Australian governments of all persuasions generally tend to, Again, I guess I would say that having been 30 years in the national security establishment by and large. But it is a struggle to keep all of those moving parts before the public in a coherent way, as opposed to a mosaic of sub-elements that sort of come into consciousness occasionally, like, say, North Korea's missile program, but then the caravan kind of moves on. I think that's the most important challenge that we have as political leaders, as senior public servants, as intelligence leaders, to make sure that we're thinking about those issues coherently, which I would contend we are under both sides of politics, but then making sure that the public commentary and the discussion of those issues remains as coherent as you can in the internet age. I didn't quite answer your question, Sam, because, as I said, we are talking about those issues. It's just very hard to keep it coherent as opposed to broken off into a mosaic of fragments.
I thought it was a pretty good answer.
Oh, thank you so much.
They all were. Thank you, Mike.
So kind of you. Thanks, Sam.